smell of old pine wood, mothballs, and pipe smoke. Though he hadn't inhaled that scent for 25 years, it was all he could do not to step back into the sunlight as the intense scent of childhood threatened to bypass all his defenses. "Well," came Doris's bright voice as she shut the door behind them. "It's a beautiful old thing, isn't it? I've always said what a shame it was shut up for so long." The woman swept into the center of the room in a swirl of pink. "What do you think?" "Fine," said Hatch, taking a tentative step forward. The front parlor was just as he remembered it, the day his mother had finally given up and they'd left for Boston. The chintz easy chairs, the old canvas sofa, the print of the HMS Leander over the mantelpiece, the Herkimer upright piano with the circular stool and braided rug. "The pump's been primed," Doris continued, oblivious. "The windows washed, electricity turned on, propane tank filled." She ticked off the items on long red fingernails. "It looks very nice," Hatch said distractedly. He moved to the old piano and ran his hand along the fallboard, remembering the wintry afternoons he had spent struggling over some Bach two-part invention. On the shelf beside the fireplace was an old Parcheesi set. Next to it lay a Monopoly board, its cover lost long ago, the pink and yellow and green rectangles of play money worn and creased from countless contests. On the shelf above lay several grimy packs of cards, held together by rubber bands. Hatch felt a fresh stab as he remembered playing poker with Johnny, using wooden matches as chips, and the vigorous arguments about which was higher, a full house or a straight. Everything was here, every painful reminder still in place. It was like a museum of memory. They had taken nothing but their clothes when they left. They were only supposed to stay away a month at first. Then the month turned into a season, then a year, and soon the old house receded to a distant dream. Shut up, unseen, unmentioned, but waiting nevertheless. Hatch wondered again why his mother had never sold the place, even after they'd fallen on hard times in Boston. And he wondered at his own deeply buried reasons for a similar reluctance, long after his mother's death. He passed into the living room and stepped up to the bow window, letting his gaze fall on the infinite blue of the ocean, sparkling in the morning sun. Somewhere out on the horizon lay Ragged Island, at rest now after claiming its first casualty in a quarter century. In the wake of the accident, Needleman had called a one-day halt to the operation. Hatch's eyes dropped from the sea to the meadow in the foreground, a green mantle that fell away from the house toward the shoreline. He reminded himself that he didn't have to do this. There were other places to stay that didn't come with the added burden of memory. But those places wouldn't be in Stormhaven. Driving to the house that morning, he'd seen perhaps a dozen Thalassa employees clustered outside of the town's sole bed and breakfast, all eager to book the 5 available rooms. He sighed. As long as he was here, he had to do it all. Dust motes drifted in the banners of morning sunlight. As he stood before the window, Hatch could feel time dissolving. He remembered camping out in that meadow with Johnny, their sleeping bags sprawled across the damp and fragrant grass, counting shooting stars in the dark. "Did you get my letter last year?" the voice of Doris intruded. "I was afraid it had gone astray." Hatch turned away from the window, tried to make sense of what the woman was saying, then gave up and moved back in time again. There in the corner was a half-finished needlepoint seat cover, faded to pastel. There was the shelf of his father's books. Richard Henry Dana, Melville, Slocum, Conrad, Sandburg's Life of Lincoln, and 2 shelves of his mother's English mysteries. Below were a stack of tattered Life magazines and a yellow row of National Geographics. He drifted into the dining room, the realtor rustling along in his wake. "Dr. Hatch, you know how expensive it is to keep up an old house like this. I've always said this is just too much house for one person. She let the thought die away into a bright smile. Hatch walked slowly round the room, his hand trailing on the drop-leaf table, his eyes roaming the Audubon chromolithographs on the walls. He passed into the kitchen. There was the old Frigidaire, trimmed in thick round pieces of chrome. A piece of paper, curled and faded, was still stuck to it with a magnet. "Hey, Mom. Strawberries, please," it read in his own teenage hand. He lingered in the breakfast nook, the scarred table and benches bringing back memories of food fights and spilled milk. Memories of his father, straight-backed and dignified in the midst of friendly chaos, telling sea stories in his slow voice while his dinner went cold. And then later, just he and his mother at the table, his mother's head bent with grief, the morning sun in her gray hair, tears dropping into her teacup. "Anyway," came the voice, "what I wrote you about was this young couple from Manchester, with two children. A lovely couple. They've been renting the Figgins place for the last few summers, and are looking to buy." "Of course they are," Hatch murmured vaguely. The breakfast nook looked out over the back meadow, where the apple trees had grown wild and heavy. He remembered the summer mornings when the mist lay on the fields and the deer came up from the woods before sunrise to eat apples, stepping through the timothy with nervous precision. "I believe they'd pay upwards of 250. Shall I give them a call? No obligation, of course." With great effort, Hatch turned toward her. "What?"
"I was wondering if you had any intention of selling, that's all."
Hatch blinked at her. "Selling?" he asked slowly. "The house?" The smile remained on Doris Bowditch's face, undented.
"I just thought that, you being a bachelor and all, it seemed, you know, impractical."
She faltered a bit, but stood her ground. Hatch repressed his first impulse. One had to be careful in a small town like Stormhaven.
"I don't think so," he said, keeping his voice neutral.
He moved back into the living room toward the front door, the woman following.
"I'm not talking about right away, of course," she called brightly. "If you find the treasure, you know. Well, it couldn't possibly take that long, could it? Especially with all that help you have."
Her expression clouded for a moment.
"But oh, wasn't it awful? Two men being killed yesterday and all."
Hatch looked at her very slowly.
"Two men?"
"Two men weren't killed, Doris. Not even one. There was an accident. Where did you hear this?" Doris looked slightly bewildered.
"Why, I heard it from Hilda McCall. She runs the beauty parlor, Hilda's hairstyling. Anyway, once you get all that money, you're not going to want to stay here, so you might as well."
Stepping forward, Hatch opened the front door for her.
"Thank you, Doris," he said, trying to muster a smile. "The house is in wonderful shape."
The woman stopped well short of the frame. She hesitated.
"About this young couple. The husband's a very successful lawyer. Two children, you know, a boy and a..."
"Thank you," said Hatch, a little more firmly.
"Well, you're welcome, of course. You know, I don't think 250,000 would be unreasonable for a summer."
Hatch stepped out on the porch, far enough so that she would have to follow if she wanted to be heard.
"Real estate prices are up right now, Dr. Hatch," she said as she appeared in the doorway. "But like I've always said, you never know when they'll drop. 8 years ago..."
"Doris, you're a love, and I'll recommend you to all my many doctor friends who want to move to Stormhaven. Thanks again. I'll be expecting your bill." Hatch quickly stepped back inside and shut the door quietly but firmly. He waited in the parlor, wondering if the woman would have the audacity to ring the bell. But she only stood irresolutely on the porch for a long moment before returning to her car, the muumuu floating behind her,
the irrepressible smile still plastered across her face. A 6% commission on $250,000, Hatch thought, was quite a lot of money in Stormhaven. He vaguely remembered hearing that her husband was a drinker who'd lost his boat to the bank. "She can't possibly know how I feel," he thought, managing to find some compassion in his heart for Doris Bowditch, realtor. He settled on the little stool in front of the piano and softly struck the first chord of Chopin's E minor prelude. He was surprised and pleased to find the piano had been tuned. Doris had at least followed his instructions carefully. "Clean the house, get everything ready, but don't touch or move anything." He played the prelude dreamily, pianissimo, trying to empty his mind. It was hard to comprehend that he had not touched these keys, sat on this stool, or even walked across these floorboards for 25 years. Everywhere he looked, the house eagerly offered up memories of a happy childhood. After all, it had been happy. It was only the end that was unendurable. If only. He stepped down hard on this chill, persistent voice. "Two men dead," Doris had said. That was pretty imaginative, even for a small-town rumor mill. So far, the town seemed to be accepting the visitors with a kind of hospitable curiosity. Certainly it would be good for the merchants. But Hatch could see that someone would have to step in as community spokesman for Thalassa. Otherwise, there was no telling what bizarre stories might spring from Bud's superette or Hilda's hairstyling. With a sinking feeling, he realized that there was really only one person for the job. He sat at the piano for another long minute. With any luck, old Bill Banns would still be editor-in-chief of the local paper. Sighing heavily, he stood up and headed for the kitchen, where a can of instant coffee and, if Doris hadn't forgotten, a live telephone were waiting. Chapter 10. The group that gathered around the antique maple table in the pilot house of the Griffin the following morning was a far cry from the noisy, eager crowd that had encircled the boat with their cheers 3 evenings before. As Hatch walked in for the scheduled meeting, he found most of the small group looking subdued, even demoralized after the accident. He looked around at the nerve center of Needleman's boat. The curving sweep of windows gave an unimpeded view of island, sea, and land. The pilot house was constructed of Brazilian rosewood and brass, beautifully restored, with intricate beadboard ceilings. What looked like an 18th-century Dutch sextant stood in a glass case next to the binnacle, and the wheel itself was carved of an exotic black wood. Rosewood cabinets on either side of the wheel held a discreet array of high-tech equipment, including LORAN and sonar screens and a geopositioning satellite grid. The back wall of the pilot house housed a massive array of unrecognizable electronics. The captain himself had not yet emerged from his private quarters below. A low wooden door set into the electronics of the back wall was closed. An old horseshoe hung upside down on a nail above the doorway, and a brass plaque on the door itself read "Private" in discreet but unmistakable letters. The only sounds in the room were the creaking hawsers and the soft slap of water against the hull. Taking a seat at the table, Hatch glanced at the people around him. He had met a few of them informally the first night, but others remained strangers. Lyle Streeter, the crew foreman, looked pointedly away from Hatch's smile of greeting. Obviously, he was not a man who enjoyed being yelled at. Hatch made a mental note to remember that although every first-year resident knew that yelling, screeching, and cursing during a medical emergency was standard procedure, the rest of humanity did not. There was a sound from below, then the captain stooped through the pilot house door. All eyes shifted as he walked to the head of the table and leaned on it with both hands, looking into each person's face in turn. There was a noticeable decrease in tension, as if everyone was drawing strength and control from his arrival. When Needleman's eyes landed on Hatch, he
he spoke. How is Ken?
Serious, but stable. There's a small chance of an embolism, but it's being monitored closely. I guess you know they couldn't recover the legs.
So I understand. Thank you, Dr. Hatch, for saving his life.
I couldn't have done it without the help of Mr. Streeter and his crew, Hatch replied. Needleman nodded, letting a silence build. Then he spoke, quiet and assured.
The survey crew was following my orders, taking every precaution I deemed necessary. If anyone is to blame for the accident, it is myself, and we have overhauled our safety procedures as a result. There can be sorrow at this unfortunate development. There can be sympathy for Ken and his family. But there are to be no recriminations.
He stood up and placed his hands behind his back. Every day, he said in a louder voice, we'll be taking risks. All of us. Tomorrow you or I could lose our legs. Or worse. The risks are very real, and they are part of what we do. If it were easy to lift 2 billion from a watery grave, it would have been done years ago, centuries ago. We are here because of the danger. And already we've been dealt a blow. But we must not allow this to dampen our resolve. No treasure has ever been buried with such skill and cunning. It will take even more skill and cunning to retrieve it. He walked to the nearest window, gazed out for a moment, then turned. I'm sure most of you know the details of the accident by now. As his crew was moving across the island, Kenfield broke into a boarded-over shaft, probably dug in the mid-19th century. His safety rope stopped his fall before he reached the bottom. But as he was being pulled out, his rope became caught in an exposed beam whose underpinnings were rotted by time. The tug of the rope dislodged the beam, triggering a cave-in and breaching the adjoining flooded shaft. He paused. We know what lessons can be learned from this, and I think we all know what our next duties must be. Tomorrow, we begin preparations for dye-testing the water pit in order to locate the hidden flood tunnel to the sea. We'll need to have the primary computer systems up and running by that point. The hard-body sonar array, the seismometers, tomographic systems, and the proton magnetometers must be assembled before work begins. The diving equipment should be inspected and ready to go by 1500 hours. Most importantly, I want the tandem pumps up and ready for testing by end of day. Needleman glanced briefly at each in turn. As my core team, each person at this table will receive a share in the treasure instead of salary. You know that if we succeed, each of you will become enormously wealthy. That may not seem bad for 4 weeks' work, until you consider what happened to Ken Field. If any of you are contemplating leaving, now is the time to do it. You'll get the standard Thalassa compensation package, but no share. There will be no bad feelings, no questions asked. But don't come to me later, saying you've changed your mind. We're seeing this through, no matter what. So speak now. The captain turned to a cabinet and extracted an old briar pipe. He removed a tin of Dunhill tobacco from the cabinet, pinched out a bowlful and placed it in the pipe, tamped it thoughtfully, and lit up with a wooden match. All this was done with deliberate slowness, while the silence around the table deepened. Outside, the omnipresent ragged island mist had grown denser, curling around the griffin with an almost sensuous caress. At last, the captain looked back and spoke through a wreath of blue smoke. Very good. Before we adjourn, I'd like to introduce you all to the newest member of the expedition. He glanced at Hatch. Doctor, I was hoping to have you formally meet my senior staff under more pleasant circumstances. He took in the group with a sweep of his hand. As most of you know, this is Malin Hatch, owner of Ragged Island, and partner in this operation. He will be our medical officer. Needleman turned. Dr. Hatch, this is Christopher St. John, the expedition's historian. He was the plump-faced man Hatch had seen looking back at him from the launch 2 nights before. A shock of unruly gray hair topped his round head, and the man's rumpled tweed suit displayed the telltale traces of several breakfasts. You'll find him an expert on all areas of Elizabethan and Stuart history, including piracy and the use of codes. And this, Needleman indicated the slovenly-looking man in Bermuda shorts, who was picking at his nails with a look of intense boredom, one leg thrown over an arm of the chair, is Carrie Wapner, our computer expert. Carrie is highly adept at network design and cryptanalysis. He stared hard at the two men. I don't need to tell you the paramount importance of cracking the second half of the journal, especially in light of this tragedy. McCallan must not keep any more of his secrets from us. Needleman continued around the table. You met our team foreman, Lyle Streeter, yesterday. He's been with me ever since our days cruising the Mekong. And here, he pointed to a small, severe, prickly-looking woman in sensible clothes, is Sandra Magnuson, the lass's chief engineer and remote sensing specialist. At the end of the table is Roger Rankin, our geologist. He indicated a broad, hirsute brute of a man who sat in a chair that looked two sizes too small for him. His eyes met Hatch's, his blonde beard parted in a spontaneous grin, and he tipped two fingers to his forehead. Dr. Bonterre, Needleman continued, our archaeologist and dive leader has been delayed and should arrive late this evening. He paused a moment. Unless there are any questions, that's all. Thank you, and I'll see you all again tomorrow morning. As the group broke up, Needleman came around the table to Hatch. I've kept a special team on the island, preparing the net grid and the base camp, he said. Your medical area will be stocked and ready by dawn. That's a relief, said Hatch. You're probably eager for some more background on the project. This afternoon would be a good time. How about coming by the Cerberus around 1400 hours? A thin smile appeared on his lips. Starting tomorrow, things are liable to get a little busy around here. Chapter 11 At 2 p.m. precisely, the Plain Jane, moving slowly in the calm water, pulled free of the last tendrils of mist surrounding Ragged Island. Ahead, Hatch could see the white outlines of the Cerberus riding at anchor, its long, sleek superstructure low in the water. Near the waterline, he made out a boarding hatch, with the tall, thin shape of the captain silhouetted within it, awaiting his arrival. Cutting the throttle, Hatch angled in alongside the bulk of the Cerberus. It was cool and still under the vessel's shadow. "Quite a little boat you've got here," Hatch called out as he came to a stop opposite the captain. The ship dwarfed the Plain Jane. "Biggest in Thalassa's fleet," Needleman replied. She's basically a floating laboratory and back-office research station. There's only so much equipment we can offload to the island. The big stuff. The electron microscopes and C-14 particle accelerators, for example, will stay on the ship. I was curious about the harpoon gun up in the bows, Hatch said. Do you spear a blue whale every now and then, when the deckhands get peckish? Needleman grinned. That betrays the ship's origins, my friend. It was designed as a state-of-the-art whaler by a Norwegian company about 6 years ago. Then the international ban on whaling happened, and the ship became a costly white elephant even before it was fitted out. Thalassa got it for an excellent price. All the whaling davits and skinning machinery were removed, but nobody ever got around to dismantling the harpoon gun. He nodded over his shoulder. Come on. Let's see what the boys are up to. Hatch secured the Plain Jane to the side of the Cerberus, then ran the gangplank across to the ship's boarding hatch. He followed Needleman through the hatch and into a long, narrow corridor, painted a light gray. The captain led him past several empty laboratories and a wardroom, then stopped outside a door marked computer room. "We've got more computing power behind that door than a small university," Needleman said, a trace of pride in his voice. "But it's not just for number crunching. There's also a navigational expert system and a neural net autopilot. In emergencies, the ship can practically run itself." "I was wondering where all the people were," Hatch said. "We keep only a skeleton crew on board. It's the same with the rest of the vessels. It's Thalassa's philosophy to maintain a fluid resource pool. If necessary, we could have a dozen scientists here tomorrow, or a dozen ditch diggers, for that matter. But we try to operate with the smallest, ablest team possible."
"Cost containment," Hatch said jokingly. "Must make the Thalassa accountants happy."
"Not only that," Needleman replied, quite seriously. "It makes sense from a security perspective. No point tempting fate." The captain turned a corner and walked past a heavy metal door that was partially ajar. Glancing in, Hatch could make out various pieces of life-saving equipment attached to wall cleats. There was also a rack of shotguns and two smaller weapons of shiny metal he couldn't identify.
"What are those?" he asked, pointing to the stubby, fat-bellied devices. "They look like pint-sized vacuum cleaners."
Needleman glanced inside. "Flechettes," he said.
"Excuse me?"
"A kind of nail gun. It shoots tiny, finned pieces of tungsten carbide wire."
"Sounds more painful than dangerous."
Needleman smiled thinly. "At 5,000 rounds per minute, fired at speeds over 3,000 feet per second, they're plenty dangerous." He closed the door and tested the handle. "This room shouldn't be left open. I'll have to speak to Streeter about it."
"What the hell do you need them around for?"
Hatch frowned. "Remember, Malin, the Cerberus isn't always in such friendly waters as rural Maine," the captain replied, ushering him down the corridor. "Often we have to work in shark-infested areas. When you're face-to-face with a great white, you'll quickly come to appreciate what a flechette can do. Last year, in the Coral Sea, I saw one shred a shark from snout to tail in a second and a half." Hatch followed the captain up a set of steps to the next deck. Needleman paused for a moment outside an unmarked door, then rapped loudly.
"I'm busy,"
came a querulous voice. Needleman gave Hatch a knowing smile and eased open the door, revealing a dimly lit stateroom. Hatch followed the captain inside, tripped over something, and looked around, blinking, as his eyes became accustomed to the low light. He saw that the far wall and its portholes were entirely covered by banks of rack-mounted electronic equipment. Oscilloscopes, CPUs, and countless pieces of dedicated electronics whose purpose Hatch couldn't begin to guess. The floor was ankle-deep in crumpled papers, dented soda cans, candy wrappers, dirty socks, and underwear. A ship's cot set into one of the far walls was a whirlpool of linen, its sheets strewn across mattress and floor alike. The smell of ozone and hot electronics filled the room, and the only light came from numerous flickering screens. In the midst of the chaos sat the rumpled-looking figure in flowered shirt and Bermuda shorts, his back to them, typing feverishly at a keyboard. "Kerry, can you spare a minute?" Needleman said. "I've got Dr. Hatch with me." Wapner turned away from the screen and blinked first at Needleman, then Hatch.
"It's your party," he said in a high, irritated voice. "But you need everything else done like yesterday."
He pronounced the word yesterday.
"I've spent the last 48 hours setting up the network and haven't done jack shit with the code."
Needleman smiled indulgently. "I'm sure you and Dr. St. John can spare a few minutes for the expedition's senior partner." He turned to Hatch. "You couldn't tell from appearances, but Kerry is one of the most brilliant cryptanalysts outside the NSA."
"Yeah, right,"
said Wapner, but Hatch could see he was pleased by the compliment.
"Quite a rig you've got here," Hatch said as he closed the door behind him. "Is that a CAT scan I see there on the left?"
"Very funny."
Wapner pushed his glasses up his nose and sniffed.
You think this is something? This is just the backup system. They shipped the main rig off to the island yesterday morning. Now that's something.
Are the online tests complete? Needleman asked.
Doing the last series now,
Wapner replied, shaking a lock of greasy hair from his eyes and swiveling back to the monitor. The team's completing the installation of the island network this afternoon, Needleman said to Hatch. Like Carey said, this is the redundant system, an exact duplicate of the Ragged Island computer grid. Expensive way of doing things, but a real time-saver. Carey, show him what I mean.
Yes, sir.
Wapner tapped a few keys and a blank screen winked to life overhead. Hatch looked up to see a wireframe diagram of Ragged Island appear on the screen, rotating slowly around a central axis. The backbone routers all have redundant mates. A few more keystrokes and a fine tracery of green lines was superimposed on the rendering of the island.
Linked by fiber optic cables to the central hub.
Needleman gestured at the screen. Everything on the island, from the pumps, to the turbines, to the compressors, to the derricks, is servo-linked into the network. We'll be able to control anything on the island from the command center. One instruction and the pumps will fire up. Another command will operate a winch. A third will turn off the lights in your office, and so forth.
What he said, Wapner added. Totally extensible, with thin OS layers on the remote clients. And everything's tweaked up the wazoo, believe you me. Miniature data packets and all the rest. It's a huge net. 1,000 ports in one collision domain, but there's zero latency. You wouldn't believe the ping time on this bad boy.
In English, please, Hatch said. I never learned to speak nerd. Hey, what's that? He pointed to another screen, which showed an overhead view of what appeared to be a medieval village. Small figures of knights and sorcerers were arrayed in various attitudes of attack and defense.
That's Sword of Blackthorn, a role-playing game I designed. I'm Dungeon Master for 3 online games.
He stuck out his lower lip.
Got a problem with that?
Not if the captain doesn't, said Hatch, glancing at Needleman. It was clear that the captain gave his subordinates a fair amount of freedom, and it seemed to Hatch that, however unlikely, Needleman was genuinely fond of this eccentric young man. There was a loud beep, then a column of numbers scrolled up one of the screens.
That's it,
Wapner said, squinting at the data.
Scylla's done.
Scylla? Hatch asked.
Yeah, Scylla is the system on board the ship. Charybdis is the one on the island.
Network testing's finished, Needleman explained. Once the island installation is complete, all we have to do is dump the programming to Charybdis. Everything is tested here first, then downloaded to the island. He glanced at his watch. I've got some odds and ends to attend to. Carey, I know Dr. Hatch would like to hear more about your and Dr. St. John's work on the McCallan codes. Mallon, I'll see you topside. Needleman left the stateroom, closing the door behind him. Wapner returned to his manic typing, and for a minute Hatch wondered if the youth planned to ignore him completely. Then, without looking away from the terminal, Wapner picked up a sneaker and hurled it against the far wall. This was followed by a heavy paperback book entitled Coding Network Subroutines in C++.
Hey, Chris! Wapner yelled. Time for the dog and pony show!
Hatch realized that Wapner must have been aiming at a small door set in the far wall of the stateroom. Allow me, he said, stepping toward the door. Your aim's not so good. Opening the door, Hatch saw another stateroom, identical in size but completely different in all other ways. It was well lit, clean, and spare. The Englishman, Christopher St. John, sat at a wooden table in the center of the room, pecking slowly away at a royal typewriter. Hello, Hatch said. Captain Needleman volunteered your services for a few minutes. St. John stood and picked up a few old volumes from the desk, a fussy expression creasing his smooth, buttery face.
Pleasure to have you with us, Dr. Hatch, he said, shaking his hand, not looking at all pleased with the interruption.
Call me Mallon, said Hatch. St. John bowed slightly as he followed Hatch back into Wapner's stateroom.
"Pull up a seat, Malin," Wapner said. "I'll explain the real work I've been doing, and Chris can tell you about all those dusty tomes he's been lifting and dropping in the back room. We work together. Right, old chum?"
St. John compressed his lips. Even out here on the water, Hatch sensed a certain air of dust and cobwebs about the historian. He belongs in an antiquarian bookshop, not on a treasure hunt, he thought. Kicking aside the detritus, Hatch pulled a chair up next to Wapner, who pointed to one of the nearby screens, currently blank. A few rapidly typed commands and a digitized picture of McCallan's treatise and its cryptic marginalia appeared on the screen.
Herr Needleman feels that the second half of the journal contains vital information about the treasure, said Wapner. So we're taking a two-track approach to break the code. I do the computers. Chris here does the history.
The captain mentioned a figure of $2 billion, Hatch said. How did he arrive at that?
Well, now, said St. John, clearing his throat as if preparing for a lecture. Like most pirates, Occam's fleet was a ragtag collection of various ships he'd captured. A couple of galleons, a few brigantines, a fast sloop, and, I believe, a large East Indiaman. 9 ships in all. We know they were so heavily laden they were dangerously unmaneuverable. You simply add up their cargo capacities and combine that with the manifests of ships Occam looted. We know, for example, that Occam took 14 tons of gold from the Spanish plate fleet alone, and 10 times that in silver. From other ships he looted cargoes of lapis, pearls, amber, diamonds, rubies, carnelian, ambergris, jade, ivory, and lignum vitae. Not to mention ecclesiastical treasures taken from towns along the Spanish main.
He unconsciously adjusted his bow tie, face shining with pleasure at the recital.
Excuse me, but did you say 14 tons of gold?
Hatch asked, dumbfounded.
Absolutely, said St. John.
Fort Knox afloat, said Wapner, licking his lips.
And then there's St. Michael's sword, St. John added. An artifact of inestimable value by itself. We are dealing here with the greatest pirate treasure ever assembled. Occam was brilliant and gifted, an educated man, which made him all the more dangerous.
He pulled a thin plastic folder from a shelf and handed it to Hatch.
Here's a biographical extract one of our researchers prepared. I think you'll find that, for once, the legends don't exaggerate. His reputation was so terrible that all he had to do was sail his flagship into harbor, hoist the Jolly Roger and fire a broadside, and everyone from the citizens to the priest came rushing down with their valuables.
And the virgins?
Wapner cried, feigning wide-eyed interest.
What happened to them?
St. John paused, his eyes half-closed.
Kerry, do you mind?
No, really, said Kerry, all impish innocence. I want to know.
You know very well what happened to the virgins, St. John snapped and turned back to Hatch.
Occam had a following of 2,000 men on his 9 ships. He needed large crews for boarding and firing the great guns. Those men were usually given 24 hours, leave in the unfortunate town. The results were quite hideous.
It wasn't only the ships that had 12 inches, if you know what I mean.
Wapner leered.
You see what I have to endure,
murmured St. John to Hatch.
Terribly, terribly sorry about that, old chap, Wapner replied in a travesty of an English accent. Some people have no sense of humor, he told Hatch.
Occam's success, St. John continued briskly, became a liability. He didn't know how to bury such a large treasure. This wasn't a few hundredweight in gold coin that could be slipped quietly under a rock. That's where McKellen came in. And, indirectly, that's where we come in. Because McKellen kept his secret diary in code.
He patted the books under his arm.
These are texts on cryptology, he said. This one is Polygraphy by Johannes Tritemius, published in the late 1500s. It was the Western world's first treatise on code-breaking. And this one is Porter's De Furtivus Literarum Notis, a text all Elizabethan spies knew practically by heart. I've got half a dozen others, covering the state of the cryptographic art up to Macallan's time.
They sound worse than my second-year med school textbooks.
They're fascinating, actually,
St. John said, a flush of enthusiasm briefly coloring his tone.
Was code writing common in those days?
Hatch asked curiously. St. John laughed, a kind of seal bark that gave his ruddy cheeks a brief jiggle.
Common? It was practically universal, one of the essential arts of diplomacy and war. Both the British and Spanish governments had departments that specialized in making and breaking ciphers. Even some pirates had crewmen who could crack codes. After all, ships' papers included all kinds of interesting coded documents.
But coded how?
They were usually nomenclators, long lists of word substitutions. For example, in a message, the word eagle might be substituted for King George, and daffodils for doubloons, that sort of thing. Sometimes they included simple substitution alphabets, where a letter, number, or symbol replaced a letter of the alphabet, one for one.
And Macallan's code?
The first part of the journal was written with a rather clever monophonic substitution code. The second... We're still working on that.
That's my department, said Wapner, pride and a trace of jealousy mixing in his voice.
It's all on the computer.
He struck a key and a long string of gibberish appeared on the screen.
Here's the ciphertext of the first code, he said.
How did you break it?
Oh, please. The letters of the English alphabet occur in fixed ratios, E being the commonest letter, Q being the rarest. You create what we call a contact chart of the code symbols and letter pairs. Bang, the computer does the rest.
St. John waved his hand dismissively.
Carrie is programming the computer attacks against the code, but I am supplying the historical data. Without the old cipher tables, the computer is hopeless. It only knows what's been programmed into it.
Wapner turned around in his seat and stared at St. John.
Hopeless? Fact is, Big Mama here would have cracked that code without your precious cipher tables. It just would have taken a little longer, is all.
No longer than 20 monkeys typing at random might take to write King Lear, said St. John, with another brief bark of laughter.
Ha ha! No longer than one St. John typing with two fingers on that royal shit-writer back there.
Jeez, get a laptop.
And a life. Wapner turned back to Hatch.
Well, to make a long story short, here's how it decoded.
There was a flurry of keystrokes and the screen split, showing the code on one side and the plain text on the other. Hatch looked at it eagerly. The 2nd of June, Anno D. 1696. The pirate Ockham hath taken our fleet, scuttled the ships, and butchered every soul. Our man of war scandalously struck her colors without a fight, and the captain went to his end, blubbering like a babe. I alone was spared, clapped in chains, and straightway taken down to Ockham's cabin, where the blackguard drew a saber against my person and said, Let God build his own damned church, I have ye a new commission. And then he placed in front of me the articles. Let this journal bear witness before God that I refuse to sign.
Amazing. Breathed Hatch as he came to the end of the screen.
Can I read more?
I'll print out a copy for you,
said Wapner, hitting a key. A printer began humming somewhere in the darkened room.
Basically, said St. John, the decrypted section of the journal covers Macallan's being taken prisoner, agreeing on pain of death to design the water pit, and finding the right island. Unfortunately,
McAllen switches to a new code just when they began actual construction. We believe the rest of the journal consists of a description of the design and construction of the pit itself, and, of course, the secret for getting to the treasure chamber. Needleman said the journal mentions St. Michael's sword.
You bet it does, Wapner interrupted, hitting the keys.
More text popped up. Occam hath unburthened 3 of his ships in hopes of taking a prize along the coast. Today a long leaden coffin trimmed in gold came ashore with 12 casks of jewels. The corsairs say the coffin holds St. Michael's sword, a costly treasure seized from a Spanish galleon and highly esteemed by the captain, who swaggered most shamefully, boasting that it was the greatest prize of the Indies. The captain hath forbidden the opening of the casket, and it is guarded by day and night. The men are suspicious of each other, and constantly make strife. Were it not for the cruel discipline of the captain, I fear every one would come to a bad end, and shortly.
And now, here's what the second code looks like. Wapner tapped on the keys, and the screen filled again. The old boy got smart, Wapner said. No more spaces, so we can't go by word shapes. All numbers, too. Not a character to be seen. Just look at that fucker.
St. John winced.
Carrie, must you use such language?
Oh, I must, old thing, I must.
St. John looked apologetically at Hatch. So far, Wapner continued, this puppy's resisted all of Chris's pretty little cipher tables, so I took the matter into my own hands and wrote a brute force attack. It's running as we speak.
Brute force attack? Hatch asked.
You know, an algorithm that runs through a cipher text, trying all patterns in the order of likelihood. It's just a matter of time.
A matter of a waste of time, St. John said. I'm working up a new set of cipher tables from a Dutch book on cryptography. What's needed here is more historical research, not more CPU time. McAllen was a man of his age. He didn't invent this code out of thin air. There must be a historical precedent. We already know it's not a variant of the Shakespeare cipher or the Rosicrucian cipher, but I'm convinced some lesser-known code in these books will give us the key that we need. It should be obvious to the meanest intelligence.
Put a sock in it, will you? Wapner said. Face it, Chris, old girl. No amount of hitting the history books is gonna break this code.
This one's for the computer.
He patted a nearby CPU. We're gonna beat this puppy, right, Big Mama? He swiveled around in his chair and opened what Hatch realized was a rack-mounted medical freezer, normally used for storing tissue samples. He pulled out an ice cream sandwich.
"Anybody want a big one?" he asked, waving it around.
"I'd as soon eat takeaway tandoori from a motor stop on the M1, St. John replied with a disgusted expression.
"You Brits should talk," Wapner mumbled through a mouthful of ice cream. "You put meat in your pies, for Christ's sake."
He brandished the sandwich like a weapon. "You're looking at the perfect food here. Fat, protein, sugar, and carbohydrates. Did I mention fat? You could live on this stuff forever."
"And he probably will, too," St. John said, turning to Hatch. "You should see how many cartons he has stored away in the ship's kitchen."
Wapner frowned.
"What?
You think I could find enough big ones in this jerkwater town to satisfy my habit? Not likely. The skid marks in my underwear are longer than the whole main street."
"Perhaps you should see a proctologist about that," said Hatch, causing St. John to erupt in a string of grateful barks. The Englishman seemed glad to find an ally.
"Feel free to take a crack, Doc."
Wapner stood up and, twitching his behind invitingly, made a gesture as if to drop his trousers.
"I would, but I've got a weak stomach," said Hatch.
"So you don't care for rural Maine?"
"Carrie won't even take rooms in town," St. John said. "He prefers sleeping on board."
Believe you me, Wapner said, finishing the ice cream sandwich. I don't like boats any more than I like the damn hinterland. But there are things here I need. Electricity, for example. Running water. And AC. As in air conditioning. He leaned forward, the anemic goatee quivering on his chin as if struggling to retain a foothold. AC. Gotta have it. Hatch thought privately that it was probably a good thing Wapner, with his Brooklyn accent and flowered shirts, had little reason to visit the town. The moment he set foot in Stormhaven, he would become an object of wonder, like the stuffed two-headed calf brought out every year at the county fair. He decided it was time to change the subject. This may sound like a stupid question, but what exactly is St. Michael's sword? There was an awkward silence.
Well, let's see, said St. John, pursing his lips. I've always assumed it had a jeweled hilt, of course, with chased silver and parcel gilt. Perhaps a multi-fullered blade, that sort of thing.
But why would Occam say it was the greatest prize in the Indies? St. John looked a little flummoxed.
I hadn't really thought in those terms. I suppose I don't know, really. Perhaps it has some kind of spiritual or mythical significance. You know, like a Spanish Excalibur.
But if Occam had as much treasure as you say, why would he place such an inordinate value on the sword?
St. John turned a pair of watery eyes on Hatch.
The truth is, Dr. Hatch, nothing in my documentation gives any indication of what St. Michael's sword is. Only that it was a carefully guarded, deeply revered object. So I'm afraid I can't answer your question.
I know what it is, said Wapner with a grin.
What?
Asked St. John, falling into the trap.
You know how men get. So long at sea, no women around, St. Michael's sword.
He let the phrase fall off into a salacious silence, while a look of shock and disgust blossomed on St. John's face. Chapter 12 Hatch opened the door on the far side of his parents' bedroom and stepped out onto the small porch beyond. It was only 9:30, but Stormhaven was already asleep. A delightful late summer breeze had gathered in the trees that framed the old house, cooling his cheek, teasing the hairs on the back of his neck. He placed two black folders on the weather-scarred rocker and stepped forward to the railing. Across the harbor, the town dropped away, a bracelet of lights, tumbling down the hill in streets and squares to the water. It was so still he could hear the pebbles grating in the surf, the clink of mast lines along the pier. A single pale bulb shone from above the front door of Bud's Superette. In the streets, cobbles shone with reflected moonlight. Farther away, the tall, narrow form of Burnt Head Light blinked its warning from the head of the bluff. He had almost forgotten about this narrow second-story porch, tucked away under the front gable of the old Second Empire house. But now, from its railing, a host of memories crowded back. Playing poker with Johnny at midnight when his parents had gone to Bar Harbor to celebrate an anniversary, watching out for the lights of the returning car, feeling naughty and grown up at the same time. And later, looking down at the Northcutt house, waiting for a glimpse of Claire in her bedroom window.
Claire.
There was laughter, and a brief, quiet babble of voices. Hatch's eye came back to the present and traveled down to the town's bed and breakfast. A couple of Thalassa employees stepped inside, the parlor door closed, and all was silent again. His eyes made a leisurely stroll up the rows of buildings. The library, its red brick facade a dusky rose in the cool nocturnal light. Bill Band's house sprawling and sagging delightfully, one of the oldest in town. And at the top, the large shingled house reserved for the Congregational minister, a study in shadow, the only example of stick-style architecture in the county. He lingered a moment longer, his gaze wandering out to sea in the veiled darkness where Ragged Island lay. Then, with a sigh, he returned to the chair, sat down, and picked up the black folders. First came the printout of the decrypted portion of McCallan's journal. As St. John had said, it described in terse terms the architect's capture and forced labor, designing a hiding place for Occam's loot that would allow only the pirate to retrieve the gold. McCallan's contempt for the pirate captain, his dislike of the barbarous crew, his dismay at the rough and dissolute conditions, came through clearly in every line. The journal was brief, and he soon laid it aside, curious now about its second half, and wondering how soon Wapner would have it cracked. Before Hatch left his cabin, the programmer had complained bitterly about having to do double duty as the computer technician. "Goddamn network setup. A job for plumbers, not programmers. But the captain won't be happy until he whittles the crew down to just himself and Streeter. Security concerns my left nut. Nobody's going to steal the treasure. But you watch. By tomorrow, once the physical plant is in place, all the surveyors and assistant engineers will be gone. History." "Makes sense," Hatch had replied. "Why keep unnecessary staff around? Besides, I'd rather treat a bad case of necrifying Madura foot than sit in a cabin like this, staring at a jumble of letters." Hatch remembered how Wapner's lip had curled in scorn.
"Shows how much you know. A jumble of letters to you, maybe. Listen. On the other side of that jumble is the person who encrypted it, looking back, giving you the finger. It's the ultimate contest. You get his algorithm, you get his crown jewels. Maybe it's access to a credit card database, or the firing sequences for a nuclear attack, or the key to how a treasure is buried. There's no rush like cracking a code. Cryptanalysis is the only game worthy of a truly intelligent being. Which makes me feel mighty lonely in present company, believe you me."
Hatch sighed, returning his attention to the black folders. The second contained the brief biography of Occam, given him by St. John. Leaning back once again to let the moonlight catch the pages, he began to read. Chapter 13. Extract follows. Document number T14-A-41298. Spool 14049. Logical unit LU-48. Research associate T.T. Farrell. Extract requested by C. St. John. Copy 001 of 003. This document is copyright by and trade secret to the Lassa Holdings Incorporated. Unauthorized use is a tortious offense and a violation of the Virginia Penal Code. Do not duplicate. Edward Occam Summary Biography. T.T. Farrell, Thalassa, Shreveport. Edward Occam was born in 1662 in Cornwall, England, the son of minor landed nobility. He was educated at Harrow and went on to spend 2 years at Balliol College, Oxford, before being sent down by the college dons for unspecified infractions. His family desired him to pursue a naval career, and in 1682 Occam received his commission and shipped as a lieutenant with the Mediterranean fleet under Admiral Poynton. Rising quickly and distinguishing himself in several actions against the Spanish, he left the navy to become captain of a privateer, having been granted a letter of marque from the British Admiralty. After a number of choice prizes, Occam apparently decided that he no longer wished to share his spoils with the crown. Early in 1685, he took up slaving, running ships from Africa's Guinea coast to Guadeloupe in the Windward Islands. After almost 2 years of profitable voyages, Occam was trapped within a blockaded harbor by 2 ships of the line. As a diversion, Occam set his ship afire and got away in a small cutter. Before escaping, however, he put all the slaves on deck to the sword. The rest of the 400 slaves, shackled together in the hold, perished in the blaze. Documentary evidence attributes the nickname of Red Ned Occam to this deed. 5 of Occam's crew were captured and returned to London, where they were hung at Execution Dock in Wapping. Occam, however, escaped to the infamous pirate haven of Port Royal in the Caribbean, where he joined the Brethren of the Coast in 1687. Confer the Lhasa document P6-B19-110292, Pirate Treasures of Port Royal, reputed. Over the next 10 years, Occam became known as the most ruthless, venal, and ambitious pirate operating in the waters off the New World. Many notorious pirate techniques, such as walking the plank, use of the skull and crossbones to strike fear into the hearts of adversaries, and riscate, ransoming of civilian prisoners, can be traced to his innovations. When attacking towns or ships, he was quick to use torture on any and all in order to ascertain where plunder might be hidden. Imposing both physically and intellectually, Occam was one of the few pirate captains to demand, and be granted, a much larger share of the spoils than his crew. During his reign as pirate captain, Occam won his victories with a rare blend of psychology, tactics, and ruthlessness. When attacking the heavily fortified Spanish city of Portobello, for example, he forced the nuns from a nearby abbey to place the siege engines and ladders themselves, reasoning that the strong Catholicism of the Spaniards would constrain them from firing. His weapon of choice became the musketoon, a short-barreled weapon that fired a lethal spray of lead pellets. Frequently, under pretense of a parley, he would gather the town fathers of a besieged city or the commanding officers of an opposing ship before him. Then, raising the weapons in both hands, he would destroy the group with a double blast. As his thirst for prizes grew stronger, Occam's brazenness grew proportionately. In 1691 he tried an overland siege of Panama City, which ultimately failed. While retreating across the Chagres River, he saw a galleon in the nearby bay heading for the open sea in Spain. When he learned that the ship was carrying 3,000,000 pieces of 8, Occam reputedly swore never to let another galleon escape his grasp. In the years that followed, Occam turned his attention ever more strongly toward Spanish gold, the towns that hoarded it, and the ships that carried it. So adept did he become at anticipating the shipments of gold that some scholars believe he was able to crack the ciphers of Spanish captains and envoys. Confer the Lhasa Restricted Document Z-A4-050997. In a single month's plundering spree of Spanish settlements in the fall of 1693, each of Occam's 800 crew received 600 pieces of 8 as their share of the booty. As Occam became more powerful and more feared, his sadistic tendencies seemed to gain ascendancy. Reports of barbarous cruelty became legion. Frequently, after overwhelming a ship, he would cut off the ears of the officers, sprinkle them with salt and vinegar, and force the victims to consume them. Rather than keep his men in check when despoiling a town, he would instead whip them into a lustful fury and then let them loose upon the helpless populace, reveling in the acts of violence and abandon that resulted. When victims could not provide him with the ransom he demanded, he would order them to be roasted slowly on wooden spits, or disemboweled with heated boat hooks. Occam's single greatest accomplishment came in 1695, when his small armada of ships successfully captured, plundered, and sank the Spanish Flota de Plata bound for Cadiz. The sheer volume of treasure he acquired, in gold bars and cakes, silver wedges and pigs, undrilled pearls and jewels, has been estimated at over $1 billion in face value alone. Occam's eventual fate remains a mystery. In 1697, his command ship was found off the Azores, drifting free, all hands dead of an unknown affliction. No treasure was found on board, and scholars of the period agree he had concealed it along the east coast of the New World sometime shortly before his death. Although many legends of varying credibility have arisen, the strongest evidence points to one of three potential sites: Ilha Vache off Hispaniola, South Carolina's Isle of Palms, or Ragged Island, off the main coast, 70 miles north of Monhegan. Printout ends. Spool time, 00102. Total bytes, 15425. Chapter 14. Hatch throttled down the diesels of the Plain Jane, then dropped anchor 20 yards off the lee shore of Ragged Island. It was 6:30, and the sun had just topped the sea horizon, throwing a gauzy gold light across the island. For the first time since Hatch had returned to Stormhaven, the island's protective mist had lifted completely. He clambered into the dinghy and motored toward the Navy-issue prefabricated pier at base camp. Already the day was warm and humid, and there was a certain heaviness in the air that presaged bad weather. As he gazed across the scene, his old apprehensions began to ease. Over the last 48 hours, Ragged Island had grown comfortingly unrecognizable. An enormous amount of work had been accomplished, more than he could have believed possible. Yellow crime scene tape had been strung around the unstable areas of the island, with safe corridors delineated for walking. The meadows above the narrow strip of shingle beach had been transformed from a place of deserted silence to a miniature city. Trailers and Quonset huts were arranged in a tight circle. Beyond, a brace of massive generators thrummed, wafting diesel fumes into the air. Beside them sat two enormous fuel tanks. Bundles of white PVC pipe flowed across the muddy ground, shielding date lines and power cords from the elements and unwary feet. In the midst of the chaos stood Island One, the command center, a double-wide trailer festooned with communications gear and transmitters. Securing the dinghy, Hatch jogged along the pier and up the rough path beyond. Arriving at base camp, he walked past the stores shed and stepped into the Quonset hut marked Medical, curious to see his new office. It was Spartan but pleasant, smelling of fresh plywood, ethyl alcohol, and galvanized tin. He walked around, admiring the new equipment, surprised and pleased that Needleman had purchased the best of everything. The office was fully equipped, from a locked storeroom full of equipment and drug cabinets to an EKG machine. Almost too equipped, in fact. Among the medical supplies in the lockers, Hatch found a colonoscope, a defibrillator, a fancy electronic Geiger counter, and a variety of expensive-looking high-tech gadgets he couldn't identify. The Quonset hut itself was larger than it looked. There was an outer office, an examination room, even a 2-bed infirmary. In the rear of the structure was a small apartment, where Hatch could spend the night during inclement weather. Stepping outside again, Hatch headed for Island One, carefully avoiding the ruts and furrows left behind by the treads of heavy equipment. Inside the command center, he found Needleman, Streeter, and the engineer, Sandra Magnuson, bending over a screen. Magnuson was like a small, intense bug, her face blue in the outwash of the computer terminal, scrolling lines of data reflecting on her thick glasses. She seemed all business all the time, and Hatch got the distinct feeling that she didn't like most people, doctors included. Needleman looked up and nodded. "Data transfer from Scylla finished several hours ago," he said. "Just completing the pump simulation now." He moved aside to give Hatch a view of the terminal. "Simulation completed at 06:39:45:21. Results follow. Diagnostics. Interlink server status, okay. Hub relays, okay. Sector relays, okay. Data stream analyzer, okay. Core controller, okay. Remote sites controller, okay. Pump status, okay. Flow sensors, okay. Emergency interrupt, okay. Q memory, 30538-5295. Packet delay, 0.000045. Checksum verification. Checksums from remotes, okay. Checksum deviation, 00.0000%. Deviation from Scylla, 0.15000%. Deviation from prior, 0.37500%. End results? Simulation successful. Magnuson's brow furrowed.
Is everything all right? Needleman asked.
Yes.
The engineer sighed.
No. Well, I don't know. The computer seems to be acting flaky.
Tell me about it, Needleman said quietly.
It's running a little sluggishly, especially when the emergency interrupts were tested. And look at those deviation numbers. The island network itself shows everything normal. But there's a deviation from the simulation that we ran on the Cerberus system. And there's even more of a deviation from the run we did last night.
But it's within tolerances. Magnuson nodded.
It might be some anomaly in the checksum algorithms.
That's a polite way of saying it's a bug. Needleman turned to Streeter. Where's Wapner?
Asleep on the Cerberus.
Wake him up. Needleman turned to Hatch and nodded toward the door. They walked out into the hazy sunlight.
Chapter 15
There's something I'd like to show you, the captain said. Without waiting for an answer, he set off at his usual terrific stride, his long legs sweeping through the grass, leaving a backwash of pipe smoke and confidence. Twice he was stopped by Thalassa employees, and he appeared to be directing several operations at once with cool precision. Hatch scrambled to keep up, barely having time to glance at all the changes around him. They were following a roped path, certified safe by the Thalassa surveyors. Here and there, short aluminum bridges spanned old pits and rotten areas of ground.
"Nice morning for a stroll," Hatch panted.
Needleman smiled. "How do you like your office?"
"Everything's ship-shape and Bristol fashion, thanks. I could service an entire village from it."
"In a sense, you're going to have to," came the reply. The path climbed the island's incline toward the central hump of land, where most of the old shafts were clustered. Several aluminum platforms and small derricks had been placed over the muddy maws of shafts. Here the main trail forked into several roped paths that wound around the ancient works. Nodding to a lone surveyor, Needleman chose one of the central paths. A minute later, Hatch found himself standing at the edge of a gaping hole. Except for the presence of two engineers on the far side, taking measurements with an instrument Hatch didn't recognize, it seemed identical to a dozen other pits in the vicinity. Grass and bushes hung over the lip and sagged down into darkness, almost obscuring the edge of a rotting beam. Gingerly, Hatch leaned forward. Only blackness showed below. A flexible, metal-jointed hose of enormous circumference rose from the invisible depths, snaked across the muddy ground, and wound its way toward the distant western shore.
"It's a pit, all right," Hatch said.
"Too bad I didn't bring along a picnic basket and a book of verses."
Needleman smiled, removed a folded computer printout from his pocket, and handed it to Hatch.
It consisted of a long column of dates, with numbers beside them. One of the pairs was highlighted in yellow. 1690, plus or minus 40. The carbon-14 tests were completed at the Cerberus' lab early this morning, Needleman said. Those are the results. He tapped his finger on the highlighted date. Hatch took another look, then handed back the paper.
"So what's it mean?"
"This is it," Needleman said quietly. There was a momentary silence.
"The water pit?"
Hatch heard the disbelief in his own voice. Needleman nodded. "The original. The wood used for the cribbing of this shaft was cut around 1690. All the other shafts date between 1800 and 1930. There can be no question. This is the water pit designed by McCallan and built by Occam's crew." He pointed to another smaller hole about 30 yards away. "And unless I'm mistaken, that's the Boston shaft, dug 150 years later. You can tell because of its gradual incline after the initial drop."
"But you found the real water pit so quickly," said Hatch, amazed. "Why didn't anyone else think of carbon dating?"
"The last person to dig on the island was your grandfather in the late 40s. Carbon dating wasn't invented until the next decade. Just one of the many technological advantages we'll be bringing to bear in the coming days." He waved his hand over the pit. "We'll begin construction of Orthanc this afternoon. Its components are already down at the supplies dock, waiting for reassembly."
Hatch frowned. "Orthanc?"
Needleman laughed. "It's something we created for a salvage job in Corfu last year. A glass-floored observation post built atop a large derrick. Somebody on last year's team was a Tolkien fanatic, and the nickname stuck. It's fitted with winches and remote sensing gear. We'll be able to look right down the throat of the beast, literally and electronically."
"And what's this hose for?" Hatch asked, nodding toward the pit.
"This morning's dye test. That hose is connected to a series of pumps on the west shore."
Needleman glanced at his watch.
"In an hour or so, when the tide reaches the flood, we'll start pumping 10,000 gallons of seawater per minute through this hose into the water pit. Once a good flow is established, we'll drop a special high-intensity dye. With the tide ebbing, the pumps will help push the dye down into McCallan's hidden flood tunnel and back out to the ocean. Since we don't know which side of the island the dye will emerge on, we'll use both the Naiad and the Grampus, spotting on opposite sides of the island. All we have to do is keep an eye out for the place where the dye appears offshore, send divers to the spot, and seal the tunnel with explosives. With the seawater blocked, we can pump out the water and drain all the works. McAllen's pit will be defanged. By this time on Friday, you and I will be able to climb down in there with nothing more than a slicker and a pair of Wellingtons. Then we can make the final excavation of the treasure at our leisure."
Hatch opened his mouth, then shuddered again with a shake of his head.
"What?" Needleman said, an amused smile on his face, his pale eyes glittering gold in the rising sun.
"I don't know. Things are moving so fast, that's all."
Needleman drew a deep breath and looked around at the workings spread across the island.
"You said it yourself," he replied after a moment. "We don't have much time."
They stood for a moment in silence.
"We'd better get back," Needleman said at last. "I've asked the Naiad to come pick you up. You'll be able to watch the dye test from its deck."
The two men turned and headed back toward base camp.
"You've assembled a good crew," Hatch said, glancing down at the figures below them on the supply dock, moving in ordered precision.
"Yes," Needleman murmured. "Eccentric. Difficult at times, but all good people. I don't surround myself with yes-men. It's too dangerous in this business."
"That fellow Wapner is certainly a strange one.
Reminds me of an obnoxious 13-year-old. Or some surgeons I've known.
Is he really as good as he thinks he is?"
Needleman smiled. "Remember that scandal in 1992? When every retiree in a certain Brooklyn zip code got 2 extra zeros added to the end of their social security checks?"
"Vaguely."
"That was Kerry. Did 3 years in Allenwood as a result. But he's kind of sensitive about it, so avoid any jailbird jokes."
Hatch whistled. "Jesus.
And he's as good a cryptanalyst as he is a hacker. If it wasn't for those online role-playing games he refuses to abandon, he'd be a perfect worker. Don't let his personality throw you. He's a good man."
They were approaching base camp, and as if on cue, Hatch could hear Wapner's querulous voice floating out of Island One.
"You woke me up because you had a feeling? I ran that program 100 times on Scylla, and it was perfect. Perfect. A simple program for simple people. All it does is run those stupid pumps."
Magnuson's answer was lost in the rumble of the Naiad's engine as it slid into the slip at the end of the dock. Hatch ran to get his medical kit, then jumped aboard the powerful twin engine outboard. Beyond lay its sister, the Grampus, waiting to pick up Needleman and assume its position on the far side of the island. Hatch was sorry to see Streeter at the helm of the Naiad, expressionless and severe as a granite bust. He nodded and flashed what he hoped was a friendly smile, getting a curt nod in return. Hatch wondered briefly if he had made an enemy, then dismissed the thought. Streeter seemed like a professional. That was what counted. If he was still sore about what happened during the emergency, it was his problem. Forward in the half-cabin, two divers were checking their gear. The dye would not stay on the surface for long, and they'd have to act quickly to find the underwater flood tunnel.